This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Pax Britannica, The Blazing World with Dr. Jonathan Healy. Today I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Jonathan Healy, Associate Professor of Social History at Oxford University's Kellogg College. His most recent work, The Blazing World, was published this year to critical and popular praise. I'm definitely one of those praising it, by the way. It's already one of my key texts. I use it in all my recent episodes. So Dr. Healy, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It's always nice to talk to a fellow enthusiast for 17th century history.
It's really clear that you enjoyed writing The Blazing World because you can just tell it comes through the pages. But other than just because, you know, you're an enthusiast of the 17th century, why did you choose to write this particular book?
It's a great question, and you are absolutely right. I think it's just an utterly fascinating period in history, and you know, particularly obviously in English history, and I've always been drawn to it because it's a period when lots and lots of stuff kind of goes on. There's a civil war right in the middle of it. There's a revolutionary moment in 1647 where it looks like a kind of social revolution is going to happen, and then of course you've got the only experiment so far in republican government in English history, and then obviously the kind of really fascinating political developments in the later 17th century, which are a bit less well known, things like the exclusion crisis and the revolution of 1689, to some eyes the glorious revolution, and so that, you know, that political story is really fascinating, and I really wanted to be able to tell that story in a way that was interesting and engaging and had a bit of pace, because obviously, you know, not all history books are written with a sort of, you know, the impetus to try and get the reader to turn the pages quite so fast. But I actually came at this from a slightly different angle, which is I trained as a social historian. I wrote my first book about the poor in 17th century England, specifically on Lancashire, actually. And I was very much kind of in that tradition of sort of history from below, history which looked at the lives of ordinary people and how those changed. And one of the things that drew me to the 17th century is that it's just a period where you can say so much about ordinary people. You know, we have so many, we have an absolute kind of cacophony of sources, everything from diaries and autobiographies to lots and lots of court records, records of the poor law, the first newspapers in England, and, you know, memoirs, all kinds of stuff, loads and loads of records, which allow us to have a much more vivid view of the lives of ordinary people. And what I was trying to do in The Blazing World was to tell a political narrative. And it is very much a sort of, you know, kind of focused on what's happening in politics and the relationship between Crown and Parliament and everything like that. But also to do it with this kind of background of a kind of really sort of vivid technicolor picture of how ordinary life is changing and how ordinary people were impacted and actually played a role in these great events.
That's really interesting. And that leads into my next question, which is, why did you choose to write The Blazing World as a narrative when that's not, you know, the default position for a lot of historians? So why did you choose to do a narrative?
And that's another great question. I had a colleague who I won't name. He may, if he ever listens to this, he may recognize this. And he was a great sort of, you know, proper kind of Marxist, actually. And, you know, very much into kind of social structure and the impact of the distribution of wealth to history, and, you know, thought about things like the rise of the bourgeoisie and all these kind of things. And he once said to me, the only thing that you can say about history for certain is that it moves forward in time. And I think that's a really important thing to remember as historians, which is that it's very easy for us to sort of look back on the past and see things kind of moving to a particular end point. But one of the great things about narrative history is that you do it the other way around. You sort of start at the beginning and you move forward. And that I think as a writer and as a historian, that sort of helps you see some of the paths which don't get taken as much as the ones which do. And you know, one of the themes of the Blazing World is paths that don't get taken. You know, in 1647, for example, 1648, there's an opportunity for a much more radical social revolution in England, which doesn't get taken. Obviously, in 1660, the Republic collapses and the monarchy comes back. It's another path which doesn't get taken. In 1685, there's this kind of vision of absolutism based on sort of toleration of both Catholics and Protestant dissenters under James II. But that collapses. It's another path which doesn't get taken. And one of the things about narrative history is it really does kind of emphasize that. But I also think, I mean, you know, it's not a textbook. And that's one thing that I think it's really important to emphasize. And when I was writing it, one of the phrases that I had in my mind, I should have had it sort of written on top of my laptop, which is, this is not a textbook. And although it does, you know, obviously I do make historiographical decisions in there, every historian has to, it doesn't sort of sit there and say, well, you know, there's this historian who says this about the reign of Charles I, and then there's this historian who says the other. So it is partly just a function of the kind of book it is, which is very much one aimed at a general readership, people who are new to the period, and therefore people who want a good story, actually, first and foremost.
And so just to linger on the question of historiography there, where does it fit within that wider scholarship, and what are you trying to say to that wider scholarship?
I mean, I think I would self-identify as a sort of post-revisionist, basically, in that you know, if you go back sort of 60 years, 80 years, even further, you have a kind of, you know, you have a view of the political breakdown of the 17th century, in which there are long-term forces at play. And then that was really kind of challenged in the 1960s and 1970s by the revisionists who made very persuasive, people like Conrad Russell, people like, you know, John Morrill, made very persuasive, very kind of sophisticated, very nuanced arguments that essentially the civil wars and to, you know, to an extent sort of later political crises were essentially caused by short-term contingency. You know, there's the famous sort of Conrad Russell argument that there's not really any point looking for the cause of the Civil War before 1637. It's all to do with that sort of billiard ball effect when things go wrong in Scotland and then in England and then in Ireland and then, you know, it sort of all collapses. And then, of course, you've got the argument that, you know, where there is a political crisis, it's the fault of a useless monarch. You know, Charles I is politically hopeless. That's the argument. James II, he's got a perfectly good hand. There's no deep lying structural issues. He's just, you know, he's just a very, very bad politician. And I kind of, whilst giving quite a lot of respect to those historians, and I use their work quite a lot, I think my view is that there are a set of much deeper causes for the political problems of the 17th century. And of those, I think where I'm a little bit different to some of my other colleagues is I do put a little bit more emphasis on social change. And let's say there's perhaps two in particular which I emphasize in the book, and one is the rise of the sort of middle sort of people. These are the kind of yeoman farmers who are prospering under the growth of population and the inflation of the early 17th century, and they're doing very well. They've got a bit more wealth, and they partly invest that wealth in education and in the law. And what that does is it means that they are literate. They can read pamphlets. They can think about religion. They also are invested in government, and that is as much kind of local government, sort of dealing with social problems like vagrancy, as much as anything else. But they're also invested in the law, and they learn how to be lawyers. They are engaged in lawsuits over their estates, and that brings them into contact with, ideology about the law, about the role of the royal prerogative, about the common law, and about Parliament, because Parliament is, you know, sort of right at the pinnacle of the English legal system at this point. So there's all that, which kind of brings in these sort of middle sort of people into contact with ideology and with the state, which I see is quite important. But at the same time, you've also got this kind of massive growth of London, and one of the most kind of, you know, one of the key characters in the book, you know, if anyone asks me who's the key character in the book, it's London, the city of London, because London has grown massively. It roughly doubles between 1603 and 1640, and then it still sort of grows a bit more slowly, but it still grows into the later 17th century. And that creates a world of profoundly literate, profoundly politically engaged, profoundly religiously engaged, ordinary people who are right smack bang in the middle of where politics happens. And some of the big set pieces in the book are moments. So, for example, in May 1640, or in December 1641, or at the so-called Battle of Turnham Green, or in the summer of 1647, where Londoners, in the Glorious Revolution as well, of course, and where Londoners are playing a massive political role as petitioners, as protesters, as pamphleteers, and as people with kind of new political ideologies. So I see those kind of deep-lying social structural factors as being ones which really kind of help destabilize politics. Another thread that people have sort of picked up on through the book is this idea of cultural conflict and culture wars. I got sort of slightly justifiably sort of picked up on it a little bit by Archbishop Rowan Williams in his review in the New Statesman. He sort of says, well, you know, he seems to be a bit obsessed with his concept of culture war. And in my defense, I kind of got it from Bernard Catt, one of the greatest historians of this period, still active. And it's this idea that there are these kind of different views of the world at play in the 17th century, and you know, most obviously when you have sort of Puritanism versus Royalism, which to me seem like very different kind of views of the world and of the cosmos, and I think those become, in some places, they become incompatible. And where I sort of link that in together with the stuff that I'd already sort of, you know, talked about is that, you know, the rise of these kind of middling sort people, they are the ones who are having these opinions about man's relationship with God and gender relations in the parish and all those kind of things. Another kind of quotation that I always had at the back of my mind when I was writing was one from the great early 20th century historian and activist Richard Tawney. And he was sort of faced with this idea that the Civil War was a bourgeois revolution, which is what you're told about by proper Marxists, I suppose. And he said, yes, of course it's a bourgeois revolution. Of course the Civil War is a bourgeois revolution. It's just that the bourgeois were on both sides. So it's a very different view. It's not a rising bourgeoisie who are trying to get into power. It's a rising of a sort of political group a social group who are politically engaged. Now, I don't use the term bourgeois because I use the term middling sort. I'm more into the sort of rural folk, but it's I find it quite a sort of convincing argument. I realize I've been talking for a while. The reason, I suppose, that I was so into that kind of view, is that my own historiographical tradition, I suppose, is to come from the sort of new social historians, you know, the sort of Keith Wrightsons, the Steve Hindles, the, you know, people like that, who have done such great work in the last sort of 40 years, thinking about how English society changed. And one of the things that they often focus on is this idea of the rise of the middling sort. And so, you know, it's partly because I came from that historiographical tradition that that became something that I emphasized quite a lot.
Very interesting. You highlight that London is the most important character in the book, because I would agree. The people of London always pop up throughout the narrative of the podcast so far. I actually have had emails from listeners confused, because I'll say in one episode that London rallied behind Parliament, and then the next one, Parliament's having to beat off royalist protesters, and they're confused. Hang on, I thought London was on their side.
And also in, at this point as well, a sort of divided urban area, because you've got the, you're starting to get a much more significant distinction between the East End and the West End. And the West End, which kind of, you know, is jurisdictionally under Westminster, is a very different place to London in lots of ways, because it's a city which is much more dependent on the royal court. And it's a place where, you know, sort of courtiers, aristocrats, lawyers, all kind of live in these quite new, quite grand, new brick-built houses that become places like Covent Garden and St. Martin in the Fields and all these kind of areas. So, yeah, I mean, London, it's in some, there's another great anecdote, isn't there, which is when William of Orange invades in late 1688, having had all this kind of, you know, outpourings of support from London. James II has fled out to Kent, and he's busily kind of having his underpants searched in Faversham, and William of Orange gets into London, and then he's suddenly faced with this kind of you know, much less support than he expects. And when he brings James II back from Kent, James II gets kind of, you know, garlanded in the streets, and William is absolutely shocked by this, because he thinks London is a, you know, a Whiggish city. He thinks it's somewhere which is going to support him. And it's similar in the Civil War. I mean, you know, London there's a very significant element of royalism. Perhaps even more so than that in London, there are a lot of people who simply want peace more than anything. And then, of course, by 1647, there is a sort of, you know, there's this kind of split in the parliamentarian side, whereby a lot of people in London are basically kind of Presbyterian, and they are horrified and scared by the growth of independency and by the growth of levelerism. So that, yeah, it's a vibrant city. It's a divided city. And I think, you know, I think the perspective of the social historian, which can look at London and look at, or, you know, look at places in England, and say, you know, it's not just a sort of stereotypical thing. It's not, you know, it's not the case that all the gentry support one side. It's not the case that, you know, whoever. There's nuance, there's debate. And you know, that then, of course, became quite a significant theme of the book, the idea of multiple voices, not trying to impose too much of a kind of of a rigid sort of typology on the way people thought. Basically, the big story is that people looked at the same stuff and came to vastly different conclusions. And that in itself is a really interesting story.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did, because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories. Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress, Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire, enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty, and about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today, and join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode, where I'd like to tell you a story.
Hi, I'm Matt Albers, host of the Pirate History Podcast. The men and women of the Golden Age of Piracy are some of the most infamous and often misunderstood characters in all of human history. You know their names. Captain Morgan, Anne Bonny, Henry Avery, Mary Read, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard. But do you know their stories, their real stories? Every week over on the Pirate History Podcast, we explore the real lives of these pirates. We examine what made these pirates sail the high seas in search of plunder and adventure and revenge. The real stories are a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the stories most of us have been told. If you'd like to hear the stories of the real men and women who went on the account and sailed under the black flag, join us on the Pirate History Podcast.
Let's talk sources, because obviously you're no stranger to this period, so the sheer wealth and variety of primary sources wouldn't have taken you by surprise when you started researching for The Blazing World. But was there anything that did surprise you, or that anything that stuck out to you while you were doing your research that you weren't expecting to find, or something that really changed the path of the book?
That's a really good question. I think because it is so much a work of synthesis, I had a pretty good idea of where it was going to go to start off with. So it's not a particularly sort of research, primary research focused book. As I say, it's a work of synthesis, although it does kind of, you know, obviously it tries to use primary sources where possible. I think in terms of the sort of surprise, I think I was quite taken by the depth of discussion about faith early on in this period. And I think, you know... In a sense, it's for a historian, it's probably a bit of a kind of platitude. But this is a very religious period, and people did kind of have quite sophisticated and nuanced views of religion, and that was the case sort of with quite ordinary people as well. And there's an anecdote that I used early in the book, and it's sort of it's. It comes as, because the book starts with a really kind of bizarre, but very funny, basically kind of mock wedding in Cartmel in Lancashire. And this was actually something that I found in the archives. And you know, most of the book is based on the brilliant work of other scholars. But this was actually something that I found in the archives in the papers of Star Chamber. And it sort of led me on to another quite famous anecdote, much more famous anecdote from Cartmel, from the same place, which is where in the 1640s they get this kind of earnest Puritan minister, and he is horrified by the level of irreligion in his parish, and he talks to an old bloke there, and he says, you know, have you heard of Jesus Christ? Which is, you know, quite the question to be having to ask in 1640s. And this guy says, I think I've heard of this man. I was at a play in Kendal, and there was a guy on a tree, and the blood ran down. I think that was him. And, you know, this Puritan minister is absolutely horrified by the irreligion of this aged parishioner who claims that he's a sort of good churchgoer. But I think my view of that kind of thing, and there's another quite famous one as well, which is just before the, and I can't even remember whether I don't think I did use this in the book, but there's so much that I had to cut out. There's another quite famous episode where it's just before the Battle of Edge Hill, and the Royalists and the Parliamentarians are both sort of tramping around the fields of Warwickshire, and the Royalists come across this local gentleman in, you know, Kyneton or wherever, and they say, which side are you on, are you Royalist or Parliamentarian? And he sort of looks at them with kind of big eyes and sort of said, what, have they had some kind of falling out? And again, it's, you know, it's used by historians as this example of how, you know, ordinary people in the countryside just don't have any idea what's going on. But I think there is another way of interpreting these, which is that they are just taking the piss. You know, there is a sort of there's a wonderful kind of irony about these people. And I am sure that's the case with the Cartmel guy, because I'm sure that he knows who Jesus Christ is. He just realizes that there's this over earnest outsider who he wants to have a little bit of sport with. And same with the Warwick thing. And I think, you know, what that kind of sort of feeds into is there's definitely one thing that really sort of came out of this, the work on this period that I ended up doing, was that just how sophisticated ordinary people were in the way that they thought about the law, they thought about religion. I remember at school, someone said, because I learned about the Civil War at school, I had a great teacher. And someone said to him once, he was like, you know, how did the peasants understand all this stuff? And he just said, well, look, you know, these people could understand Shakespeare. They were not stupid. It's a funny way of putting it, of course, but because, you know, does anyone understand Shakespeare? But there's a real kind of kernel of truth there. And I think one of the things that I was really, really, really kind of adamant to do in that book is not to condescend to people in the 17th century, and to really kind of try and understand them as rational human beings. You know, people who are faced with these really complicated issues, and come to different conclusions about them, not because they're, some of them are stupid or anything like that, but because these are complicated issues and because there are multiple valid ways of thinking about them.
Absolutely. And they're complicated issues with the highest possible stakes. I mean, your questions are about the fate of your immortal soul. You want to get it right.
Absolutely. But also, the other really kind of sort of quite stirring thing that I actually found about the period was that the, questions about your immortal soul are absolutely a really good example, actually, because, you know, in some ways, in a time of uncertainty, and of course, the 17th century, there's a huge amount of uncertainty. There's political uncertainty, there's social crisis, there's inflation, there's the little ice age, there's all this kind of stuff going on. There's massive war on the continent. So people are understandably a bit uncertain about the world. There is a sort of arguably a kind of natural tendency in those kind of circumstances to go back to what you know, and to kind of, you know, kind of retreat into a sort of, you know, conservative worldview, you know, the comfort that that might provide you. But actually, lots of people didn't in this period. They actually went the opposite way. They sort of thought, well, you know, how do we reform society? How do we change people's relationship with God? As some of the reviews have pointed out, I do have a certain amount of kind of, you know, you try and be an objective historical, objective historian, but there's a lot of sympathy in there with the visionaries and the free thinkers, and, you know, people like the Quakers who come up with this completely new way of experiencing faith. You know, the levelers who are able to think about what does it really mean to have the safety of the people at the center of our political ideology, and how do we make sure that the people are actually part of the political political setup, and how are they protected? And, you know, these people, they managed in what was fundamentally a very sort of backward looking culture. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I just mean it in an objective way, in that people looked to the past for inspiration and for direction. But yet still, some of these people managed to think up these kind of really kind of remarkable proposals for social and political and religious change. I mean, you have people advocating, a national health service, for example. You have people advocating legal aid. There are some people who argue that there shouldn't be the death penalty, for example, which, of course, you know, in the UK, that we've got there, but they haven't everywhere in the world. I just think some of the thought that comes out of often quite ordinary people in this period, men and women as well. You know, one of the tragedies of this period is that the political upheavals of the 17th century, of the middle of the 17th century, probably kind of held back any kind of discussion of gender relations, really, and probably helped to sort of reinforce the kind of patriarchy that you have at the start of the period, and you know, is reinforced by the end. But in the middle of the period, there are, you know, people willing to sort of talk about women's rights and the women's liberation and things like that, and just, you know, in that society, it just is remarkable that people were able to do that. So I find that, quite inspiring, actually.
Well, let's focus in on one of the things you touched on there, the idea of people thinking of new ways to look at the world and new ways to govern and all of this stuff. You touched on the levelers, so I want to jump ahead of where the narrative is at the moment. So this is a spoiler, but John Lambert famously drafts the instrument of government. Now, I wonder if you could explain to the audience what the instrument of government was and how was it received?
The instrument of government is the first attempt at a written constitution for not just England, but for England, Scotland, and Ireland. And it's an attempt to put down basic kind of fundamental principles of the constitution, and it's a sort of, you know, it's an attempt at a balanced constitution. It's you have a Lord Protector, which initially would be Oliver Cromwell, and his rule was tempered by Parliament, and of course is tempered by the existence of this written constitution. And amongst the sort of constitutional protections were things like religious toleration for those who profess a belief in Jesus Christ, basically, as long as they're not sort of openly Catholic or openly advocating for the rule of bishops. So it's a very imperfect kind of toleration, but in the context of the time, it is relatively wide. It also does things like franchise reform as well. It changes the basis of who can vote. It's still only men, but it can be men who don't own land at this point, although they have to have a certain amount of non-real property. And it also reforms sort of constituency boundaries, so places like Leeds and Manchester get MPs for the first time. But I think what's really interesting for me about the instrument of government is that it is a sort of it's a sort of modernizing step. Now, it may be a very imperfect one, but it's the very fact that it basically looks at the constitution as it is, and instead of doing the normal thing for that period, which is to say, right, what's the precedent? What's the ancient constitution? What have things been like from time immemorial? It actually says, no, we're going to think about this rationally. We're going to use reason, and we're going to say, right, okay, this town should have an MP, even though it's never had one before, because it's a big town. And by doing that, it was actually a really quite significant break from the constitutional norms. It was inspired by levelers, because they argued for written constitutions and fundamental constitutional protections, although it ended up being a sort of relatively conservative document in many, many ways. It wasn't a sort of social revolutionary document. The trouble was, John Lambert was a soldier, and a fairly kind of, you know, he's from a sort of middling sort of Yorkshire gentry background. He's from Malham, he'd risen through the ranks. He'd become the sort of one of the leading soldiers under Fairfax and Cromwell, and he was clearly probably more intelligent than either of them, actually, and more thoughtful, certainly more intelligent than Fairfax, who's a bit sort of, you know, he has this kind of fatal weakness in the eyes of the people in positions of responsibility in the middle of the 1650s, which is that he's just plain old Soldier John. And that means that any constitution that he gives, that he provides, is fundamentally coming from the soldiers. And one of the things that in the 17th century people were very invested in is, where does power come from? In some ways the Civil War is a debate about where power comes from. Does it come from God, or does it come from the people? The parliamentarians argue that basically it comes from the people. It's not the same thing as arguing for democracy. They're talking about where power comes from. The trouble is with Lambert is that as much as he kind of dresses it up as a sort of, you know, a constitution which is rational and comes from the people, fundamentally it comes from the army. It's been presented to Cromwell by a general. The hope is initially that it will then be ratified by Parliament. Parliament will say, yes, great idea, brilliant constitution, John, we'll take that on, and we'll give that our seal of approval, therefore giving the seal of approval of the representatives of the people. unfortunately for Lambert and for Cromwell, they don't do that. They instead sort of start to say, well, hang on a second. We want to create our own constitution. We want to do it our way. We don't want this plain old Yorkshire soldier coming and telling us how many, you know, how many constituencies there should be or who should be tolerated. So it has a very, very rough ride, and it basically sort of falls apart in late 1656, 1657, just after Cromwell has attempted to rule through major generals, so kind of military local government, if you like. One of the most notorious elements of the Republic's history was, you know, attempt to impose some form of military rule on local communities. Didn't work very well. And after that, there is also a big sort of celebrity trial, if you like, where a Quaker called James Naylor had walked into Bristol on the back of a donkey, whilst his followers kind of threw leaves in front of him, so imitating Christ's entry into Jerusalem. And what Naylor was doing is he was acting out this kind of fundamental Quaker belief that the inner light, Christ, is in all of us. But it looked very similar to blasphemy to a lot of people, not least because Naylor himself used to wear sort of long hair and kind of flowing robes, which is how people thought Jesus dressed at the time. So anyway, the problem with that was that it was very unclear under the instrument of government whether or not they could do anything about Naylor. Because remember that clause which says, toleration for anyone who professes to believe in Jesus Christ, as long as they're not a Catholic or an Episcopalian. Well, Naylor isn't a Catholic or an Episcopalian, and he definitely believes in Jesus Christ. He just thinks that he just has a particular view. So that kind of celebrity trial, which happens in Parliament, and the issue over the major generals, then basically kind of does for the instrument of government. And what happens is one of the most kind of celebrated, notorious, depending on your view, moments in the Republic's history, which is that a group of MPs offer Oliver Cromwell the crown. And it's a very interesting offer. It's a really interesting offer, because what they're not doing is they're not saying, let's go back to, you know, monarchy. We'll just have the House of Cromwell versus the House of Stuart. It's absolutely not that. They are arguing for a very different kind of monarchy. It's a crown which has been given by Parliament. Therefore, it is vested in the sovereignty of the people, because that's what Parliament represents. Ironically, then, Cromwell turns it down because he thinks that God has cast down the idea of monarchy. So he sort of, you know, he goes against it. But he does accept this kind of new constitution, the additional petition and advice, which has come from Parliament. And the way to think of this is that it's basically a kind of civilian coup against Lambert, who then goes off in a sulk, because he's lost power. But those kind of, you know, I think one of the things I was trying to do in the book, is to, give the constitutional and political struggles of the Republic their due, because I feel that sometimes in treatments of that period of history, there is a sort of focus on, you know, the sort of dowdiness of Cromwell, the alleged dowdiness of the Puritans, and, you know, all the theatres being closed. Whereas actually there are these really kind of sophisticated and for me fascinating debates about power, about the constitution, which are not ended by the regicide. If anything, they become bigger. You know, you suddenly got rid of this ancient constitution, what do you do? And there's various different attempts to kind of answer that question. But that fundamental question of where does power come from? Does it come from the people? And in what way, if it does come from the people, in what way can they best be represented, becomes a kind of running theme throughout the 1650s.
During the Republic, almost ironically, it's a point you make in The Blazing World, in the 1640s, the radicals were very political. But then from the 1650s, that kind of radical energy disperses into religious thought instead.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could speak a bit more about that.
Yeah, and I think there is a tendency among people looking at the 1640s and 1650s to think in terms of the defeat of radicalism. And, you know, obviously Gerard Winstanley's kind of, you know, sort of proto-communist communes on the Chilterns and in St George's Hill, Surrey, they obviously don't last. The Levellers are politically defeated. But I think if we think about this from the point of view of people at the time, where they would be just as worried about their immortal soul and as they are about their right to vote, I think we can overblow, we can overdo the idea of defeat, because movements like the Quakers, movements like the Baptists, they survive. And, they enter into a period of persecution in the 1660s and 1670s, but they survive that as well. And they come out of the revolution strong enough to become this kind of dissenting radical tradition. It's just that it's not secular, it's religious. And I didn't in the book, but I do sometimes describe the Quakers as the sort of the greatest ever English peasant radical movement, because it was unlike a lot of peasant radical movements in the early modern period, it was successful. They lasted. They're still there today. There's loads of Quakers around. I'm not sure how proud they'd be of Richard Nixon, but they have survived as a movement, and they are they are fundamentally in this period. They are fundamentally bottom up. They are ordinary. They get a lot of their strength from ordinary farmers, and not just in London as well. The other thing that I found really really kind of great about the Quakers is that they took hold. Their stronghold was in the north of England. It was in Westmorland. It was in North Lancashire. It was in the Pennines. And so this idea that there's a sort of there are radicals in mid 17th century England, but they're all they're all in London, and they don't fundamentally have much purchase around the country. I think the Quakers really problematize that, because they take hold in little villages in the Pennines, which you wouldn't expect to be right at the forefront of sort of radical movements. One thing I was really keen to kind of emphasize is that although that sort of level of radicalism obviously kind of didn't take hold, although more so I suppose than people often think. I always think of John Wildman, the great leveler, who ends up being the running the post office for William of Orange. So, I mean, he survived fine. But the really kind of long lasting radical movements from the middle of the 17th century were the religious ones, the Baptists, the Quakers, even people like the Muggletonians, who don't exist so much anymore. But, it was a lasting legacy, and it sort of, it was passed on through generations into the 18th century and beyond.
Just as a final question, just to finish off, in The Blazing World, you include a lot of fun asides and anecdotes and little things you found in the records. Were there any that you wish you'd been allowed to keep in?
No, not at all. My editorial team were fantastic. There was so when I first wrote the book, the first draft was considerably long. I mean, you may find this hard to believe, but it was considerably longer than the one which has ended up on the bookshelves. And most of it was pretty similar, actually. I had a chapter on the on sort of global developments as well, but that didn't really fit the book very well. But I also I spent a lot more time looking at the kind of social background to start off with. And I had a really kind of fun chapter about attitudes to sex and marriage in the early 17th century. And the sort of political relevance of this was that in the early 17th century, it's a sort of period of pressure on society, and that manifests itself in, kind of worries about, worries about sexuality, worries about gender relations, worries about marriage. And I started it with this incredible anecdote of a very sort of complicated, series of affairs in Spitalfields in London, which I'd found in Star Chamber. Having all those chapters in to start off with meant that the flow at the beginning, where it's so important of a book that at the start, it's got to keep moving. And, you know, this ended up being a sort of 80,000 word discussion of, you know, the problems in 1605 or whatever. So that had to come out. And I am a bit sad about that. But the it's one of these things where, as a writer, and you just finished your PhD, so you'll know exactly what I mean. As a writer, you can't include everything. And there is a real, particularly writing this kind of book, there's a real imperative to have a cohesive narrative, but also one which doesn't sort of sit still for too long. And so some of that stuff, unfortunately, had to go, but maybe for a future publication.
Before we finish off, if there are people in the audience who really want to give The Blazing World a read, which I highly recommend, where can they find it?
All good bookshops, many bad bookshops as well. There are, if you can find yourself near a Toppings, then they have plenty of signed copies. And the paperback is due out in 2024, early on, I think. I've just seen the cover and it looks great. They've done a fantastic job.
It's currently out in hardback and ebook.
Yes. Yeah, and there's also, you can also get a audiobook version, which is narrated by the wonderful Oliver Hemsborough, and that's another option. It's about 18 hours long, so you need to have a bit of time, but yeah, very good.
Brilliant. Well, Dr. Healy, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
What did it take to survive an ancient siege?
Why was the cult of Dionysus behind so many slave revolts in ancient Rome?
What's the tragic history and mythology behind Japan's most haunted ancient forest?
We're Jen.
And Jenny.
From Ancient History Fangirl. Join us to explore ancient history and mythology from a fun, sometimes tipsy perspective.
Find us at ancienthistoryfangirl.com or wherever you get your podcasts.